Okay, today is October 13th, 2011. This is an interview with Gail Mattson. We are at the Society of Women Engineers National Conference in Chicago, Illinois. This interview is being recorded as part of the SWE Grassroots Oral History Project, and the interviewer is Troy Eller. Gail served as the SWE National President in fiscal year 2001, and this year has been elected to the Society's College of Fellows. She currently serves as the Secretary General of the International Network of Women Engineers and Scientists Education and Research Institute. Gail is currently the Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of PAI Corporation. Thank you for joining me today. Could we start off by, could you tell me a little bit about where you were born and grew up?
Oh. Boy, we're going way back. I was born in Kansas City. Let's see, I was there until about third grade. And then my family started moving. My father was an engineer. He's both a mechanical and a chemical engineer. And he worked in the pipeline industry. So we moved a lot. So since then, we moved like every 3 years while I was growing up, different parts of the United States and different parts of the world. So...
Okay. Did your father encourage you to become an engineer?
Well, yes and no. I was always interested in science. My mother was in the medical field. She was a medical lab technologist. And so originally I wanted to be pre-med. So my undergraduate degree is in chemistry and biology. So I was originally pre-med and I applied to medical schools. Unfortunately, I was competing against all the Vietnam vets that were coming out, and they were coming out of the medical corps, and they were getting priority. And so even though I got selected to be interviewed at six different medical schools, I didn't get in. And so then I I started working for Bechtel. I worked at Bechtel during the summers. My father worked for Bechtel. I worked at Bechtel during the summers as a summer student in engineering. And so when I didn't get into medical school, I went and talked to my boss. And he says, well, you can just continue working for Bechtel. So they went ahead and kept me on full time. So I started my career at Bechtel and worked in cost schedule engineering. Okay. And I did that for a number of years and then decided, no, I think I'll try engineering. So then I applied to graduate school and got a master's degree in environmental engineering, where I used all that chemistry and biology plus what I'd learned at Bechtel in engineering and went into environmental engineering.
Okay. Mm. Okay. So you chose chemistry and biology originally because you wanted to study medicine.
Yeah. Well, I knew I was good in math and science. I really enjoyed it growing up. And so that was what I was originally thinking was the medical field.
Okay.
So, because my mother was in the medical field.
So, what was your experience in the chemistry and biology departments?
At the time, there was very few women. This is a story I shared in my my installation speech when I was installed as the president of SWE, is my mother was my original, both my parents were role models. But obviously being a girl at the time, I was taking my mother in the medical field. My mother had gone to Baker University, private Methodist school in Kansas. And she had been, at that time, she was looking at going into either medical lab technology or nursing. And so she was on a science program. And unfortunately, the professor there in the chemistry department didn't believe that women should be going in, getting degrees in science and so forth. And so even though she knew she was making a passing grade, he gave her an F. And there was two gals in his chemistry class, and he flunked both of them. My mother was determined. She went and retook the course, and she knew she passed. And he reluctantly gave her a D so that she would pass. And she went on and graduated with her degree in chemistry and went on and became a medical lab technology. When I was applying to college, one of the schools I applied to was Baker University. But I'd also applied to schools in California because at the time my family was living in California. And I was really thinking that's where I was going to go. I got this phone call one day from Baker University saying, congratulations. You've won a full chemistry scholarship. And by the way, it is the Dr. Crego chemistry scholarship. Well, that was the professor that had flunked my mother. My mother started screaming and yelling and jumping around. She says, I hope he's rolling over in his grave knowing my daughter got his chemistry scholarship to go study chemistry at Baker. So she was vindicated and in terms of sticking with chemistry. So that, I mean, as I said, she was really a role model for me in getting in that stick-to-itiveness and making sure you got through it. Accomplish what you want to do.
Mm-hmm. So there weren't many women in your chemistry department.
In my chemistry class, no. There was, I think I have a class of maybe 50, there was three or four of us.
Do you think that affected your studies at all? Or?
No, I think I expected that. I expected that. And obviously the gals, we all grouped together. We were a study group together. But we just saw it as a challenge. And worked our way through it. But the guys were very, very supportive. Really, they were. The guys in our class were very supportive. Of course, we got some hassles because we were the top of the class. We worked really hard. So we were got accused, you know, of moving the curve and so forth, you know. But we were determined. We were going to be top students, and all of us made the Honor Society at Baker University in graduating in chemistry and biology.
Okay. Could you tell me about your experiences working at Bechtel?
Mm-hmm.
Are there any memorable stories from when you were there?
Well, as I said, I started working for Bechtel in the summer as a summer student while I was going to college. My father got me the job because he worked at Bechtel. And it was interesting because they brought me in and I thought I'd be working in a technical position and as an engineering aide because that's what they had talked to me about through my father. And when I went in that first year, they wanted me to take some tests. And I go, what kind of test do you want me to take? Well, they sat me down and wanted me to take a typing test. And I asked them, I said, but I'm going to be an engineering aide. Don't you want to know how I work on a calculator, how I can do with numbers and so forth? Well, all women take the typing test. Well, of course, I knew how to type, but I was mad. And so they had this little test that you had to type. Well, I typed the test and I inserted sentences about how I thought it was inappropriate that I had to take this typing test to be an engineering aide. And the gal looked at the results and she saw what I did and she said, you passed, and just moved on. But I saw her reading those sentences when she was looking at it because her eyes got real big and she just said, okay, passed, and went on to the next one. So I got the job at Bechtel. So even though I sort of modified the typing test.
Right. So you worked for Bechtel mm-hmm. in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. Were there many other women?
There was a few that were engineering aides. But at the time, Bechtel was expanding, and they needed as many young engineers coming in as possible. So there was a group of us. I know that first summer, there was about a group of us, about 50, that were all summer students, and they had a training program. And there was like four or five women in our group and a bunch of young guys. But the men at that time were really, really supportive. I mean, they thought it was great that there were some young gals, you know. And we were all in the training program together, very supportive. The odds were great. I mean, I always had dates for lunches and usually two dates on the weekend. So it was great, the odds. So
so it was a positive experience.
It was a positive experience. You know, besides the typing test, I mean, there was obviously some of the engineers, some of the older managers I worked with were very skeptical. And we definitely had to prove ourselves. But I guess I was conscious of that from being in undergraduate school, the same thing. I knew I had to work a little harder, and I knew I had to prove myself because they were going to be, you know, skeptical and asking questions and so forth. And I did have the comment, well, the only reason she got this job is because her father worked for Bechtel. And so I wanted to prove that, no, I did. Well, maybe that's how I got the job, but that's not how I'm going to keep the job. And I was asked to come back subsequent years. And so I worked at Bechtel three different summers.
Okay.
So, and I think because I proved myself the first summer, I got the job the second ones. And I got more responsibility in those subsequent summers doing other things.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why did you decide to pursue a master's in engineering then? Okay.
After I graduated with my chemistry and biology, as I said, I tried to get into pre-med, did not get in. I had also, by that time, was engaged, and I was engaged to an engineer working at Bechtel. And we had an opportunity, he had an opportunity to work on a project up in Canada. And so I made the decision, instead of trying to get into graduate school, and pursue, I was looking at a graduate school in like biochemistry or something so I could stay in the pre-med field. We looked at this opportunity in Canada, and it was an excellent opportunity for him, a promotion for him. And they came back and said, Gail, we do have a position for you in Canada. So we decided to go ahead and get married and go to Canada. Mm-hmm. So I sort of like got sidetracked. And then from Canada, we spent 3 years in Canada, and I worked as a cost schedule engineer there. Then we had an opportunity to go to Saudi Arabia, and it was a big promotion for him, big promotion for him. And they had a position for me. And at that time in Saudi Arabia, not that many women were allowed to work. So the fact that Bechtel had a position for me was, what could we say? You know, they were willing to send us over there. We both had well, good paying positions. So I went to Saudi Arabia for 2 years. But then I realized that by that time I'd worked for Bechtel for 5 years. I had engineers working for me that were making more money than I did because they had an engineering degree and I just had the science degree. And so that's when I decided if I was going to go ahead and make it in engineering, I needed to go back and get an engineering degree. So I applied to the University of Washington while we were working in Saudi Arabia, and I got accepted at the University of Washington. So actually, I came back and started at the university and went for 3 months, then went back to Saudi Arabia while my husband finished his contract. And then after we both finished our Bechtel contracts, then I came back to the University of Washington and went full time.
Okay. I'd like to backtrack a little bit. And okay. What were your experiences in Saudi Arabia?
Interesting. Very, very interesting. I love the experience. I'd highly recommend it, but you have to have an open mind. I knew Bechtel did a great job of preparing us. They had several courses that we went through preparing us what the culture would be like, what the Muslim culture would be like, what the restrictive culture in Saudi Arabia would be like, what the health situation would be, also the climate and so forth. They did a great job of preparing us, so we knew what we were getting into. But it's still a shock when you land at the airport at night and it's 95 degrees and 95% humidity and you get ushered into this airport and it's just this mob of people and it's not air conditioned and the smells and everything, that first, you know, impact when it hits you. But we were prepared. We were ready for it. And I just understood. I'm a guest in their country. These are their laws. These are their rules. And so I dressed appropriately and make sure I had something covered on my hair. I did not wear a veil or anything, but I dressed very modestly and always made sure I was covered. My arms and legs were covered because that's where their rules, that's their laws, and I wanted to be respectful of that. It was a great opportunity for me. I met some wonderful people working over there. Unfortunately, I was only able to work for 1 year. While we were there, they had the big religious uprising in Iran. And the Shiite Muslims at that time, which were the minority Muslims in Saudi Arabia, got to the king of Saudi Arabia and said, "We, you know, if you don't want us to revolt like we just revolted in Iran, you need to abide by our demands." And so they had a list of demands that they wanted the king of Saudi Arabia to succumb to, I guess. And one of them was Western women working in men's jobs. They were really upset because Saudi Arabia had been looking the other way and letting more and more Western women come into Saudi Arabia and work in men's jobs. Well, obviously, engineering was one of those jobs. So he came out on the radio and made the announcement of these changes that he was going to immediately apply across Saudi Arabia, and one of them was that. So my boss came to me and said, "Gail, we've got the situation. You can no longer work in this position, but what we're going to do is, since you're in the middle of a couple projects, we're going to move all your stuff to your trailer and let you work out of your trailer and finish these projects up, and then we'll put your hours as overtime on your husband's paycheck." So that's what they did. So for the next couple of weeks, that's what I did. I worked on those projects and finished them up. They were hoping during that time things would sort of settle down and I'd be able to go back to work. That didn't happen. And it was just that political situation, that religious situation was so up hot at that time, it didn't happen. So I could no longer work. But I sort of took it as a time, great, because I had worked all through high school. I'd worked all through college. I started working for Bechdel like 2 weeks after I graduated from college. And, you know, except for a week off for a honeymoon, I'd worked straight through. And so I thought, well, this is a great opportunity. I'll just take the time off and travel. So that next year that we were in Saudi Arabia, I was able to visit 12 countries. I did two things. I worked for a travel agent that was over there, and she was looking for someone, the couple was looking for someone that at the Bechdel compound that could sell travel tickets for these travel opportunities. And so I worked as a travel agent for them, and they would pay for my airfare to get all these Americans and Europeans signed up to take all these trips out of Saudi Arabia. So I got to go to India and Sri Lanka and Nepal and Syria and Egypt and travel as a travel agent. So I really enjoyed that. Got to visit a lot of countries as a travel agent. And then I started Girl Scouts. They desperately needed to have Girl Scouts. We had all these little girls and no scouting program, no after-school program. And I've been very involved with the Girl Scouts. So the other thing is I did is I worked with New York headquarters for Girl Scouts, and I started Girl Scout troops there at the compound in Saudi Arabia. So between the two, I kept me pretty busy until my husband finished his contract, and then we could come back to the States.
Okay. So when you came back, you returned to your master's
went to graduate school at the University of Washington, got my master's degree in environmental engineering. Mm-hmm. And then from then on, and then as when I graduated, I started working for a time that the company was called Envirosphere. It was the environmental division of Abasco Services. They had office there in the Seattle area, and I started working for them. And I ended up working for them for 17 years.
Mm-hmm. So. Did you notice any differences between your experiences as studying chemistry and studying engineering? Was there a different culture between the two disciplines, or?
Well, there was like a 10-year difference because I'd worked for Bechdel and in University of Washington. What was interesting at the time is they were really just developing and expanding their environmental engineering program under the civil engineering department. So it was still really in a really growth stage. And so I was part of that group of first graduate students that was really developing that environmental engineering program. And there was a number of women, but we were all women that had all worked in other careers or other areas and came back. So all of us were not, you know, young 20s, we were all in our late 20s, early 30s, helping develop the program. But there again, there was probably, I think there were six women in the group, but it was a small class, about 30, you know, six out of 30. But the professors were very, very supportive. I really felt, you know, treated as an equal in graduate school at that time. So the only challenge there is the first year was the toilet situation. And this is crazy, but I know the women talk the same story. We didn't have a women's toilet. All the toilets in the whole building were all for men. The only women's toilet was the one that the dean's office staff used behind the dean's office. So, but we petitioned, and we finally got one of the men's toilets turned over to a woman's toilet because we got tired of walking past the dean's secretary to go use the restroom or hiking over to the student union.
And this would have been around 1980 or so?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So why did you choose environmental engineering?
A couple of reasons. One, obviously, I had a strong background in chemistry and biology, but also the projects I'd worked on, I saw the environmental impacts we were having. The project up in Canada, the tar sands project up in Canada, I really saw during the construction what we were doing to the environment. And Bechdel was at the time following the requirements, but I saw there was so much more we could do in terms of erosion control and thinking ahead. When you're building a plant in a pristine environment like that, there's more we could have probably done to make the plant and what we're doing more environmentally responsible. And I saw that firsthand being on a large, huge construction project. And the same in Saudi Arabia. I mean, here we are going out to a pristine desert and an environment, and you're building this huge complex and pulling all this oil and natural gas up to build this big complex. There again, I could see what we were doing to the environment, and it really bothered me that we weren't thinking ahead of how we could have controlled a lot of the waste and done a better job. And when I question it, people go, well, it's not required, so we're not going to do it. Well, there's environmental responsibility, too. At the same time, I mean, that was in the 70s when the environmental laws, that's when your NEPA came out, your National Environmental Policy Act, that's back in the 70s when you had the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and so forth. And it was just an interest of mine reading about those acts and so forth. So when I came back and I started thinking about what do I want to do, I really wanted to take my background in chemistry and biology, my interest in the environment. And so that's one reason I picked the University of Washington, because they were one of the first universities that was putting together a master's degree in environmental engineering. There was only a few universities at the time that were doing it. So that's where it was, I guess. It was interesting because there was engineers that were in the environmental program that had a not a strong background in chemistry and biology. I remember in some of the classes, like the water quality class, we were doing some chemistry, and some of them didn't know how to use a microscope. So here I am trying to teach engineers how to use a microscope. They kept going down and breaking the little, you know, the cover sheet on the on the slides because they hadn't used one before. So
okay. Did you notice a different attitudes towards women in science and technical fields between then and when you went to school 10 years prior?
I think at that time, the environmental area was booming, and they were just looking for anybody mm-hmm. that was really interested in going to the environment. I think the fact that I had the undergraduate degree in chemistry and biology, that I had work experience, I didn't have any problem getting into graduate school at all. I mean, mm-hmm. it only took them a couple of weeks to get back to me and say, you're in, because they were desperately looking for people in this new growing field. And as I said, there was just six women in the program, but all of us had had work experience and a background in the sciences, so we were readily accepted and felt really part of the whole program and had a lot of say-so in how we developed the program. So it was very different than undergraduate school.
Okay.
So, but there again, it was just a numbers thing. When there's only six of you out of the whole department, you know, you're a minority. Mm-hmm. But I noticed that the civil engineering department at the time was doing a good job of recruiting. And I could see every year there was more and more freshmen coming in as freshmen in civil engineering departments. University of Washington was actively trying to recruit women at the time, a lot more than some of the other universities were.
Okay. Yeah. Can you tell me about finding your job search after you finished your mm-hmm. degree?
So I used the placement office there on campus, and they did an excellent job of setting up interviews. I had the opportunity to go back with Bechtel because I had taken the leave to go to graduate school. But at the time, Bechtel was still trying to figure out what this new environmental field was, and they weren't quite sure whether they wanted to really stay in the environmental field or just subcontract it out. So I went back and interviewed with Bechtel in San Francisco my last semester in graduate school. But at the time, they said, well, you can have your old job back doing project controls, cost schedule engineering, but we really don't have an environmental opening. So then I went back to Placement Center and said, look, I really want a job in environmental engineering. And so they set up interviews with me for several different companies. And I actually ended up getting two job opportunities. One was the one I took with Abasco, the environmental group, and the other one was CH2M Hill. I had two offers. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I went with that one with the Abasco.
Okay. Were there any particular reasons why you chose Abasco?
Two things. One, I got the offer first. I got it 2 days before I got the one from CH2M Hill. And the other one was money. They offered more money. So it was pretty... At that time is pretty straightforward. So, yeah, when I got the offer from CH2M Hill a couple of days later, I really thought about it, but then I looked at the money, and there was a dramatic difference in the money. So I went with the higher-paying job at the time.
Okay. What were some of your experiences at that company and in later companies?
Mm-hmm. We were at that time. It was growing. I mean, at that time too, Abasco had this environmental department, and they were growing and hiring all these new young people. So most of the people I was working with were other young people, and so it was a very supportive environment. And we were breaking in, you know, new environmental laws, new environmental field. So it was sort of exciting. And so we were sort of like creating what we were doing. You know, we were looking at the new interpretations of environmental laws, and we were developing new programs for the clients, the big industrial clients, on how to interpret all these environmental laws. And at that time, later on in 1980, with the new Superfund Act, that was brand new. And everyone was trying to figure out, what are these waste sites and how are we going to clean them up? So it was exciting being a group of young people that we were all trying to develop and interpret these environmental laws and what was going on. So I really felt part of that group. The rub was when we had to go back to the other side of the company to get support under your classic disciplines. So we would be coming up, like we wanted to put a wastewater treatment plant. We would come up with the chemistry, the engineering of what we want, but we'd have to go back to the other side of the building to the engineering departments for like civil engineering for foundations and so forth. That's where we ran into the problems, because you had the staid old engineers in civil engineering or electrical engineering, and we would go into meetings and they would talk to the guys and they would ignore us, you know. And even though maybe I'm leading this project, it was hard to get the eye contact, because you had these civil engineers in their 50s that were used to working with men, and they didn't know what to do with this young woman who was leading this project for a new wastewater system or something. So it was just persistence. Mm-hmm. It was just persistence. I knew that's the way they were, and it was just a matter of proving myself to them. And luckily, most of the young men I was working with, my, you know, co-workers, were very supportive, and they would definitely make a point. Well, Gail's in charge of the project. Gail needs to answer that question, you know. Mm-hmm. And I always made sure I had the agendas, and I had who was speaking on the agenda, so it was very obvious who was running the meeting. So just learning some techniques like that. But part of it was having supportive co-workers. I know one incident that I did have to deal with. Well, there's two different stories I'd like to share. One of them, we were looking at an opportunity to support an Abasco subsidiary up in Alaska, in search mining, and they had a gold mine up there. And they had gone through corporate saying, look, we have a problem with our wastewater discharges from our gold mine in Alaska, and we're getting all sorts of citations and so forth, and they're going to shut down the gold mine because we have too much arsenic and other chemicals coming out of our wastewaters. We need someone to come up here right away that can deal with this issue. And so they came down, you know, to the head of our group, the environmental group, and said, oh, who do you have available? And so my boss came to me and said, you know, there's an opportunity. Are you interested? And I said, yes. You know, I don't have kids. I'm flexible. You know, I can jump on a plane. I can go up to Alaska. This would be a perfect challenge, you know, prove myself on this project. And, so he is going ahead, okay, we started the process. Well, then he went back to the corporate to tell them who was going. Well, they found out that I was a woman, and they go, well, we can't send a woman up to Alaska by herself. And they came back with all these questions. One question was, what does her husband think? Will her husband allow her to go? I mean, I just started laughing. I mean, I didn't ask him. I told him I was going, this is a new job assignment. He was very supportive. But it came down to, they would not let me go alone. They insisted that the environmental department send someone else up with me. And so my boss had to go with me because corporate told him he had to come with me. So he went up there with me. He introduced me around, stayed one day while we kicked off meetings and says, you're in charge, you know what we're doing. They flew back to Seattle. But that was an insistence from corporate that they did not want me going up there by myself. They were concerned. But he knew I could do it. He was comfortable. He just went along because, you know, he had to play the game.
Right.
So we had another opportunity. After I'd been there a couple of years, our office in New Jersey had won the big Superfund contract with EPA. And there again, they were expanding and growing and adding new people and so forth. And the lead person for the contract, he was an outstanding man, did a really, really good job. And he had brought in one of his friends, one of his co-workers, to be his deputy. Unfortunately, this deputy had some personality quirks that were rubbing the wrong way with the EPA people in Region 2. And finally, EPA came back and said, look it, you got to get rid of this guy. He is not working out, and he's offended people at EPA. You can't offend your client. you need to bring someone in immediately that can fill his shoes and help expand the program and train new project managers. And so they looked across the company and they contacted my boss, and he came to me and said, look, here's an opportunity. We need to send you to New Jersey for at least 6 to 9 months until we can, as a temporary, until we find a new deputy project manager. And I was just thrilled. I was absolutely thrilled. So, but he told me that when he called back there and said, they said, we need you to send your best guy, send your best man, you know, who's the best person. And he said he very, very made it very clear. He says, yes, and I'm sending her, and you're going to love her. She's going to do a great job. He made a point. But they were very, very receptive. Mm-hmm. And it was a great assignment working back there. And I ended up being there almost 9 months. It took him that long to go through the process of finding a new person and getting him trained and getting him up to speed and so forth, that EPA would accept the new deputy. But it was a fun experience being back there.
Did you have any mentors that was helping you to, you know, shape your career while you were there?
I had a built-in mentor was my father. Mm-hmm. I always looked to my father since he worked for Bechtel, had experience as a project manager. I always enjoyed, you know, calling him and saying, here's a situation. How would you deal with this? You know, I've got this boss, or I've got this coworker, or I've got this employee with this situation. And he was always very helpful, very, very supportive, very helpful in helping me work through issues, bounce some ideas off of him, but very supportive of my father was. I think because I moved around a lot, I worked with lots of different people. And I think I can't just name one. There'd be several different people, very supportive, and very understanding, but not one specific one. They did not have like a formal mentorship program or anything like that within the company the 17 years I was there. But there was a number of coworkers that were very supportive and very helpful.
So. Okay. Why did you decide to leave the company?
I got another job opportunity. By that time, I was working with a company in Oak Ridge. I'd been with them, like I said, almost 17 years. We had put together a team to bid on the environmental management contract for the Department of Energy in Oak Ridge. And there was two major teams. That was the Bechtel-Jacobs team, and there was the Foster Wheeler team. At that time, Foster Wheeler had bought Ebasco Environmental, so now I was an employee of Foster Wheeler. And I was one of the key positions on the Foster Wheeler team. And we came in a close second. We almost won. It was a close second. I was involved in the debriefings. I was one of the key people on our proposal. Within 6 months after Bechtel-Jacobs got the contract, I got this phone call one day saying, would you like to go out to lunch? And I met with the deputy project manager from Bechtel-Jacobs. And he said, here's the situation. We bid people on the original contract, but some of these people we need to move to other positions. And he says, within a year, these key positions can move, and we need to backfill these key positions. And so we're looking for top-level managers that we can hire and bring in to step into those positions. And so what's that they did? So they essentially offered me the job that I had originally proposed on as part of the Foster Wheeler team to come to work for Bechtel-Jacobs. So I had a great opportunity, ended up with Bechtel-Jacobs for 4 years.
Okay, so. Okay. At some point, you were working as a consultant.
Mm-hmm.
What was that experience like, and why did you decide to do that?
When I had my own company for a year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I told you things, but, you know, I was at 17 years with Ebasco, Ebasco Environmental, and then Foster Wheeler. There was a point there when I was in the Seattle office that we had some change in management. The supportive managers that give me a lot of opportunities, we had a change. And we had looked at expanding and working in some other areas. And I worked very hard on these proposals to win this work for the company, with the understanding that I would be able to get one of the key positions on these proposals. And the new manager that came in overrode that. And we won two contracts that I had worked really hard on winning those proposals. And he brought in other people from his previous employer or contacts he knew and put other people in those positions. And after the first one, it was like, well, this would be a relocation for you, and your husband's working here, it might not work out for you, so I thought it was better to put this other person in. Okay, I'll get you some slack. The second time, it was really obvious. He knew I worked on the proposal. He knew I wanted that position, and he brought somebody else in to fill the position. And so I realized I was hitting what you call a glass ceiling. It was a brick wall. There wasn't any glass there. It was a brick wall. I could tell that this man was not going to give me an opportunity further there with the company. So that's when I decided to go out and branch on my own and start my own woman-owned business. Mm-hmm. It was really growing at the time, really booming. And the proposals I'd been working on, I saw that we had to show for federal government agencies like EPA that you had a certain percentage of small businesses, and some were woman-owned or disadvantaged and so forth. And so I had knew firsthand that was a requirement. So I started my own environmental consulting business as advanced in environmental engineering, and was able to get a couple of jobs. I got a job for CH2M Hill, yeah. Supporting CH2M Hill on one of their contracts. And then with another competitor, I got a contract working over at the Hanford site, working on a major project over at the Department of Energy site over at Hanford, Washington. And I did that for about a year. And then I got a phone call back from Abasco saying, we have an opportunity in Chicago we would like you to consider. Mm-hmm. So this was coming from corporate, above this guy. And they had opened a new office. They needed to open a new office in Chicago for the Superfund program. And they needed someone that knew Superfund program inside and out that could handle it. And so I hired back with the company, and they moved me to Chicago. I opened the office and ran the contracts there for them. So I have kept my consulting company all this time. Mm-hmm. I pay my corporate dues every year because I want that fallback just in case something happens. I can fall back, and I still got my consulting company in case I ever need that.
Okay. Through all this time, were there more women because it was you were in environmental engineering and that was a newer field, or were you still...
You know, obviously the numbers are less. There's just fewer women in engineering. But since the environmental was a new field... Mm-hmm. There's more women. I think if you look at the statistics, there's more women in the environmental field than there are in your classical mechanical and civil and electrical. There's just more women in the environmental because it's a newer field, a younger field, and a growing area. Mm-hmm. So,
okay.
But the numbers are still less. I mean, I still get the, oh, you're an environmental engineer. Okay.
What helped you to succeed throughout your career?
Oh, I guess a number of things. One is, as I said earlier, just what I learned from my mother, that you got to stick to it. Stick to it. If you know this is what you want to do, stick to it and just keep working. And, you know, don't be discouraged and just look for another way around. You know, just don't keep beating your head against the wall, but stand back and go, well, go sideways, go try this or try something out, or, you know, build something to scale over it, whatever. You know, don't be stopped. Keep looking for the opportunity and keep moving forward. So I think that's always helped me. And I think part of it is just very, very supportive coworkers. I've always tried to establish a really good working relationship with my coworkers. And having the support of the coworkers, I think, really makes it a lot easier because you have a team. And if your team is a winning team, then you're going to get noticed by everybody. And the whole team is going to advance as a team, depending on your individual, you know, capabilities. But everyone's going to look good. So I think that's always helped, having strong relationships and supportive coworkers. And I supported them when they had opportunities for advancement and recommendation, and they in turn would recommend me and support me for my opportunities for advancement. So especially when you have people above you in corporate positions that are not as supportive for women, I think having that strong support from coworkers maybe overcomes some of their reluctance, you know, when you have that kind of support.
Okay. Mm. How do you think that the profession has changed for women you know, now as compared to when you first started? What do you think are the differences or even the similarities?
Obviously, because we have more young people now that have come up through the ranks, you know, when I started engineering, that are very supportive of women in engineering. So that's changed a lot, really has changed a lot. So there's a lot more support now, especially now, too, that they have daughters. You know, most of the people in my age group all now have daughters that are in their 20s and 30s, you know, that have wanted to go to school. And so it's a different perspective. When your daughter wants to go to school and go to engineering, you want to support her, you know. So they have that identity directly about supporting their daughters wanting to advance in engineering or science. So you have a whole different feel. They have a different understanding about women in engineering. So when I first started, most of the men that I was working with did not have daughters going into engineering or science, so they didn't identify with it. But that's changed with this next generation. So it makes it more open.
Okay. What do you think are some of the challenges that women still face in the profession?
I think part of it is the corporate structure. And a lot of the engineering companies, they're trying to change. But until this next generation really is in the senior management position, it's going to be hard. And hopefully it'll change within the next 10 years. Is you've got these people that are in their 60s that are retiring, and you have the new ones coming up that have are used to working with women in management and senior and peer positions, then it's going to make a difference. But as long as you have an old structure in place, corporate structure in place, and you still have these men in their 60s that are used to sitting in a boardroom with all white men in their 60s, it's going to be hard. But hopefully it'll change in the next 10 years or so. With the new group of men coming up that are used to working with women as peers, that will change. But it's still hard, and you have some old corporate structures that are in place that are, they're used to doing things a certain way, especially engineering companies. They get very stuck in their ways and their patterns and their procedures and their structures, and they're not as flexible. But I think they realize to be competitive today, they've got to be more flexible. They've got to look at another way of doing things. And I think incorporating women and more minorities in a lot of positions is going to make a difference. And because that's why I mentioned white men. I think they realize there's a lot of minorities, you know, that also have a lot to offer, and they need to be more open to having minorities in senior management positions. Mm-hmm. So things are going to be changing. They have to change. If they want to be competitive in the work environment, they're going to have to change if they want to stay, you know, competitive.
Okay. When did you first join SWE, and why did you choose to join?
I joined SWE when I was in graduate school at the University of Washington. Actually, I tried to join SWE when I first started working for Bechtel in San Francisco, when I was a cost schedule engineer. And because they had advertised SWE meetings, I saw it on the bulletin, and I was working for Bechtel in the corporate office. And so I actually turned up at one of the SWE meetings that they were hosting there at the Bechtel office in San Francisco. But when they found out that I did not have an engineering degree, my degree was in chemistry and biology, they said I couldn't join because I was an engineer, even though I was working in an engineering position as a cost schedule engineer, and I was going through all the Bechtel training to be a project controls engineer with everyone else. So it sort of ticked me off a little bit. I understood where they were coming from. They told me the story, you know, they needed to have credibility, and they only wanted women with engineering degrees for credibility. But I wasn't there very long, because then I got shipped off to Canada, and then from there I went off to Saudi Arabia, so they obviously didn't have to worry, there wasn't a SWE in Canada or Saudi Arabia. But then I went back to graduate school at the University of Washington, and they had a very active student section. And I saw the advertisements, so I thought, well, I'll go check things out. Of course, they weren't quite sure what to do with me because I was a graduate student. And mainly at SWE at that time was an undergraduate program. But one of the meetings I went to, I think it was like the second meeting I went to, they had a joint meeting with the professional section for the Pacific Northwest. And I met a lot of those women and identified with them. And so I joined as a graduate student, but I actually started going to the professional section meetings. Because that's where I really identify. Because I already been out of school working for 10 years. Mm-hmm. So I joined as a graduate student.
When did you start taking on leadership roles within SWE?
About a year after I graduated and started working. They were looking for someone to chair one of the committees. And so took the old hand up and volunteered. So I started working committee, and then I think the next year I got elected as the alternate delegate for section rep and just start working up from there.
Okay. Do you think that your involvement in SWE had any impact on your career?
Definitely. I think it helped me learn about the importance of networking. You know, it's one thing because you're focused in your company and you're focused in your job and your team and so forth. But I think networking has made, especially in the environmental field, has opened me to the good results from networking. That you need to meet people of all different backgrounds, all different kinds. Because in the environmental field, you need to interact with scientists, you need to interact with politicians, bureaucrats. And so by networking with SWE, I've learned the process of networking and how valuable networking is and how to be able to meet people from all different backgrounds and incorporate that into what you're doing. So I think that was very helpful for me. That first committee I was on was hosting, it was a during the Women's Month there in Seattle, they would get various women's organizations got together and had a big dinner and a big fundraising. And so I had to interact with the women scientists, women in medicine, women in accounting, and a couple other professions. And we'd get together and have this big professional women's thing and big fundraiser and so forth. And so I met a lot of really interesting women in other areas. And that's, I guess, got me interested in, like I said earlier, understand the power of networking and how it can help in your career.
Okay. So. Why did you decide to become involved nationally in SWE?
At that time, I was in the Chicago section, and I had filled various office positions at the Chicago section. And they were looking for someone to start working on national committees. And we had someone there that had been a president of SWE. And she had approached me and said, we really need more women working on these national committees, and we really need help with membership. And I had been involved in the efforts to grow and expand the Chicago section. And also had helped develop a professional development workshops that we did there at Chicago that were very, very successful. And so this past president of SWE had approached me and said, would you consider working on a national committee and taking some of the things that were successful here in Chicago and trying at the national level? So my first foyer was into the membership committee, and I got involved in the membership committee and looked at what we needed to do to communicate membership and the benefits of SWE and so forth, and that's how I got involved. So that was Kathy Cunningham, who was the president of SWE, and she had recommended that. And, you know, once you get into national committee and people see you, then your name gets picked for this and picked for that. Next thing I know is, well, you want to be on the board, and then I end up being the vice president for membership, and you're on your way.
What was your goal as national president? What did you want to focus on?
Let me remember back. That was a few years ago. I had several goals. One of the goals was to put together effective working relationships with other women's organizations. And the two that I had really had a passion about was the Girl Scouts and Girls Inc., Girls Incorporated. And so one of my goals when I was president was to establish memorandum of understandings with those two organizations and really formalize the relationship so we could really grow. And so that happened. While I was president, we did those MOUs, one with the Girl Scouts to really sort of expand our program for STEM for the Girl Scouts. And the other one was Girls Inc. and supporting their, they called it a SMART program. And it was science, math, and related technology SMART program, putting those modules together. And actually, SWE helped Girls Inc. write their proposal to the National Science Foundation to get the funding for that SMART program. And then when I was past president, I served on a local committee that was implementing one of the modules for the SMART program. That was a lot of fun. Galaxy Girls, a lot of fun. And was able to pull SWE members in from NASA to help support the Galaxy Girl program. It was a good program. So that was one that I wanted to do. The other one, and this was one that I saw as the board that we had to do, we had to do something with headquarters staff. We were growing, and we had a small office in headquarters that had been there for many years, and we had headquarters staff that were very, very capable, but technology was changing. And so we needed to do two things. We needed to expand in order to support the society, and the office space we were in, we could not expand. There was no more room in that building for it to expand. And it was going to get very, very expensive. They were looking at completely changing the rent structure in New York. And so we were going to pay a lot more for the rent for the same space. But also we were looking at putting in a computerized membership database. And that's the same time we were kicking off our website. And so we needed people in headquarters that knew how to do databases, and we needed someone that could do website and start using the internet. And the staff we had in New York could not handle that. And we tried sending them out for training, and they could not get it. They had been with SWE for years. They were phenomenal women. I really, really admired them, but they couldn't make the transition to the internet and computerized membership database. And so we looked at, what are we going to do? We've got to do something. We're stuck, you know. And so when I was president-elect, we started looking at that. And what we looked at, other societies, how did you do it? How did you deal with this? And that's where we heard about outsourcing and found out that other professional societies were doing outsourcing. And so I started the effort as president-elect, and we did it as president. We went out and put together a proposal, and we got proposals from four different companies. And we narrowed it down to two and interviewed two companies. And that's when we selected Bostrom mm-hmm. in Chicago. So my year was the year that we shut down the New York office and moved SWE to Chicago with outsourcing at Bostrom. Mm-hmm. So a major change. A major change. I had people saying, Gail, you're absolutely crazy. How are you doing this? And I go, we don't have a choice. We have got to change if we're going to grow. And that was the best choice. Mm-hmm. So luckily, I had a very supportive board. You know, I kept giving them information. Here's the facts. Here's the information. Here's our options. You know, this is what we want to propose. And luckily, I had a very, very supportive SWE board at the time, and they elected, yes, and they voted, yes, we're going to outsource, and they supported the selection of Bostrom. So it was a tough year. It was a tough year shutting down New York mm-hmm. and letting those women go and moving to Chicago. But if you look at the statistics and you look at SWE history, after that move, things improved.
You know, headquarters had been in New York for so many decades. Did anyone fight against this decision or kickback?
Yeah. Yes, I got numerous comments. Mm-hmm. I had, you know, past presidents even and longtime members, you know, come up to me at the national convention, send me letters, you know, making all sorts of comments about what we were doing. But I just very politely wrote them back. I said, we don't have a choice. We've got to move out of the space, and we've got to change. We've got to go electronic. We've got to go with the internet. We've got to change. And this is what we did. We tried, and it didn't work, mm-hmm. you know. So, but I think within a couple of years, when they saw how well it worked and the success from it, then the naysayers were, okay. Mm-hmm. And actually, one of them came up a couple of years later and told me, Gail, you're right. It was the right decision. I was wrong.
Did you receive support from your companies or your company as you were president?
Yes. Yes. When I was president, it was when I was at Bechtel-Jacobs, mm-hmm. and they were excellent. Bechtel was very, very supportive. And because I did a lot of traveling. I mean, when I originally had approached them, you know, about the position, I gave them an estimate of the travel requirements and so forth. But at the time, I didn't know we were going to be moving the headquarters, because I ended up spending a lot more time going up, flying up to New York, flying to Chicago, going to extra meetings. But they were excellent. They actually set up a separate corporate account for me. And so it sometimes up to a third of my time would be charged to SWE, to that corporate account mm-hmm. for the travel and being away from the office and so forth. So they adjusted my workload accordingly and got support. But I knew when I was in the office, I focused on getting my work done and making sure that it was done and communicating it. And I always, I know I made a, sometimes I think overboard, making sure everything was covered when I was gone and who was in charge and who was handling what and how to get a hold of me while I was traveling. Because I wanted to be supportive of Bechtel. And we, and at the time, we had a very challenging project. We had a lot going on there and a major wastewater, waste management program. And I wanted to make sure we were doing a good job. But at the same time, I was very thankful that Bechtel gave me that charge number, and I knew, you know, I said, okay, I'm going to stop working on this, and now I'm doing SWE. So I'm sitting over here, and I actually had two desks. I had my regular work desk, and then I had another desk behind me where I had all my SWE stuff. So I'd swivel the chair. Okay, I'm on SWE time now. I'm thinking SWE. So I was really admiring them that they were that supportive.
Okay. What do you think were some of the benefits that you gained from your experience as president?
Time management, you know, learning how to set priorities, delegate, and that's why I made a point earlier about the delegation. I you know, through my career, I'm used to working on project teams, but I also was always in charge of being in charge, you know, and making sure everything was done. And when I got into working on the SWE board as an officer and then president-elect and then president, I learned I can't do everything, but you can delegate. And so I think one of the things I learned was the delegation and, you know, identifying people in the project and making sure everything was covered while I was doing the SWE business. And then also learning at SWE, you can't do everything. As a president, you can't do everything. You have to rely on your board members and your committee members, and you have to rely on the headquarters staff to do what they're going to do. You have to hold them accountable, and it's hard as volunteers to do that. But realize there's really, really good people out there, and they want to do a good job. Just give them the opportunity and delegate to them. You know, and you always have a couple incidents where something happens, someone gets sick, or something falls through. Yeah, you recoup. You reassign it. You get it done. You know, the world's not going to fall apart. You know, you're upset because maybe that Girl Scout event didn't go off the way it was planned. Eh, well, do better next time, you know.
Right. What do you think's are some of the challenges that SWE is going to face in the future?
Right now, I know they're really dealing with the budget issues. I mean, everyone's right now with the economy, not knowing what's going to be the federal budget and how it's going to impact corporate partners. And I know there's been issues with corporate partners cutting back on their support. So obviously, there's a financial challenge. But at the same time, as we said earlier, I think most of the corporations realize that they need to change. They need to have new young people. They need the brightest minds, and that means including women and minorities. And they know that. If they want to be successful, they've got to embrace that. And SWE is one way for them to do that. It's a way for them to have that pipeline to outstanding women engineers, and it's a way to be noticed in their for recruiting. That if you're not acting like recruiting and supporting like SWE, and you're in the magazine, you're on the website, and you, then you're going to be noticed and attract. And women engineers are going to want to work for your company because you're showing that kind of support. So I think that's still there. It's just, how do you come up with the dollars to do that in tight economic times? So I think SWE's just got to be sensitive to that and be able to work with our corporate partners. How can we deliver and provide them with what they're looking for with maybe some restricted funding? How do we do that? Maybe do more in kind, where they do services versus just writing a check. Mm-hmm. How does that work? So I think we're going to have to be more creative working with our corporate partners on different ways to get support from them besides just writing a check. So we'll have to be creative there. So I think that's one area. I think the other is just the concern about math and science education. I have a number of friends that are educators, and they're just really concerned with the education in the United States right now and a lot of the problems. And we got so tied up with just training children how to pass tests that we weren't training them how to think. And there's so much concern about that. And you're looking at other education systems around the world that are more successful than the one here in the United States. And what do we need to do to change, to get the kids excited about learning? Really excited about learning and want to learn math and science. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know what the answer is. I just know it's a real concern. And I think SWE needs to stay involved on being the forefront in Washington, D.C., advocating proper STEM education and teaching our children how to think, not just memorize stuff to pass the test. We've got to figure out how to get that message across. And I think SWE needs to be part of that voice in Washington doing that.
So. Okay. I would like to switch over to NWIS.
Okay.
And your involvement in NWIS.
Okay.
How did you, you know, first get involved with it?
When I was the membership, VP for membership, and we got the website up and running, all of a sudden we started getting these emails from women around the world wanting to find out about SWE. And there was two groups. One was SWE members working abroad, that how could they stay in contact with SWE members as large while they're working abroad, because obviously we couldn't afford to ship the SWE magazine to them. How can we support SWE members working abroad? But also there was these women that maybe had come to the United States, got their master's degree in engineering, and were now back in their own countries. And they had learned about SWE, were involved in SWE when they're in undergraduate or graduate school, and they wanted to take that concept to another country. So we were getting more emails and inquiries from women in other countries. How can we do something similar? Or if they had their own women's organization, how can we learn from SWE and how can we work together, share best practices? And so I really noticed that when I came very aware of that when I was the VP for member services. And then I went on to president-elect, and I just realized that this was a real need for us to interact with women around the world. The women engineers and scientists are already out there that had organizations that wanted to share best practices with SWE, and we could learn from them. Like Women Engineer Society in UK is even older than SWE. We could learn from them, but also how we could share. And the world was becoming global. We knew more and more SWE members were going to be working abroad. How do we support SWE members? And how do we get them involved with their sister engineers in other countries working together? So when I was past president, I was asked to represent SWE at this opportunity to look at forming an international network. Women in Canada had gone to the United Nations, UNESCO, the United Nations Education, Science, Cultural Organization, and had gotten funding to put together a task force to look at setting up an international network of women engineers and scientists. That when UNESCO had a goal for trying to get more women into science and technology. And this was one of the things that they were looking at doing, was setting up some kind of organization. So I represented SWE, and Kathleen Hare was the other representative, another past president of SWE. We were the two representatives that went to the meeting in Canada to sort of brainstorm how will this work. And they had women from 20 countries that were there that had been funded by this UNESCO grant to do this investigation. And we came up with, yes, let's form a network, and we came up with the name, the International Network of Women Engineers and Scientists. And so the ICWIS, the International Conference of Women Engineers and Scientists, this was the 12th conference, was gonna be there in Ottawa, Canada. And so we had met in May and came up with this idea for the task force, and then we rolled it out in July at the ICWIS 12. And everyone that was there voted, yes, let's form this international network. And the network would be a continuous organization. I don't know if you're familiar with the background of ICWIS, but ICWIS was just a conference. And every 3 years it would be a conference. And you had this committee of women from 11 different countries that worked to help get the next conference and find a host for the next conference. But it was really up to each host organization or country to host ICWIS, and it varied a lot between the different conferences, and everyone sort of started from scratch of how to put the ICWIS together. And then they had some years where they had to reschedule because of political turmoil or lack of funding and support. So there were some rough years there about having ICWIS, and especially another big problem that happened was after 9/11. And when travel from foreign countries became more and more difficult, and getting visas from developing countries and so forth became more difficult, it was hard to get the travel papers for women coming from traveling from other countries. When you're having a conference, but there's not an organization behind the conference that has credibility, that can sign the paper saying, yes, we're sponsoring this person and we're sponsoring that visa for that person to come to this conference. And it was really, we were made aware of this by the Canadian women that were organizing ICWIS 12 there in Ottawa, that they had received excellent paper from some women in Africa and in Asia and so forth. And they wanted them to be able to come. But as an organization, a committee, they couldn't sponsor their visas. And Canada was very, very strict. If you were going to bring women to a conference, they had to be sponsored by an organization. And the university there at Carleton and Ottawa University were supporting the conference, but it wasn't their conference. So they weren't willing to use their letterhead to sponsor the women to come. And as a result, they had like 60 women that had accepted papers and posters that couldn't come because they couldn't get visas. Mm. And so one of the things we looked at forming the international network was being a recognized international organization that could sponsor these visas to help these women come to the conferences. And that's made a big difference.
Okay.
So when we formed INWIS, it was one, to have a network that could sponsor the women, have a legal entity. Two was we wanted to build and make the ICWIS stronger from every 3 years. And when it's a separate disjoint, you don't have that. By having the network in place, you could have a committee that could work with making the conferences better each year. And we learned that at SWE. When SWE had been a volunteer national conference, each SWE hosting section sort of did it separately, and it really didn't grow. Once we had headquarters and a convention management firm managing the SWE conferences, they really improved because you got the lessons learned, you learn from that, you've got consistency with headquarters and convention management firm, it improved the conferences. So INWIS is trying to do the same thing with the international conference. Let's have a committee, let's work on lessons learned, let's help support the next host country in what they're doing, putting together guidelines, helping with mailing lists, helping them plan it. And as a result, the ICWIS have been growing and getting better since we've had INWIS working with them for more consistency. And we help them since INWIS can help in their front year planning. You don't wait until the third year to plan it. We can help them on year one and year two and year three with corporate sponsorships, mailing list, getting the call for papers out. And it's just working better as a mechanism, having the network do that versus the disparate different committees trying to do it. I think the other thing we're trying to do is, and INWIS, is help women in countries that don't have an organization start one. And there's never been an entity out there to do that. And so we have women that come to the ICWIS conferences, they get all excited, they want to do something, but they don't have the resources to go back to their country to start their own association. INWIS can provide that support. We provide seed money for them to start. We have a manual now that we put together that talks about how do you start an association. And we've gone out and done training at regional conferences to women and go, this is the steps. This is how you start an organization in your own country. And as a result of that, I know we've got 8 new organizations that have started because of INWIS support in doing that. So, and as hard as I think, there is no other entity out there that could do that. So those are things that we're doing, making the conferences better, more productive, providing the support for visa and the paperwork, and then helping start associations in other countries that don't have them.
Okay.
So those are 3 primary goals. We have some other ones, but those are the main ones for starting INWIS.
What have been some of your experiences working with international women engineers? What have you learned, or what differences have you seen?
It's been a lot of fun. It's been a lot of fun, that's for sure. And I've learned a lot. Boy, my eyes have been opened by other cultures and so forth. I think the main thing I've learned is we all have the same goals. We all have the same goals. We just have different ways of getting there based on our cultural background and our expectations. And so a big part for me has been learning to listen, you know, and obviously I'm a person that likes to go in and get things done and get things organized, you know, make that project out, make assignments and go forward. But I've had to learn that women in other countries with other cultures work a different way. So I've had to sit back and really listen. Where are they coming from? What do they need? What thought process do they need to go through in order to make a decision to support something? And so that's taken a while for me to learn. But once I learned that, I think it's been, obviously for me, I think it's helped me in my career, because now I can be more open to people from different cultures and background working in your company too, mm-hmm. that have those differences. But I think part of it is just seeing the success of seeing the light come on and this woman finally understand, oh, this is what it's all about. That's what you were trying to say. And then, oh, they're in it 100% and want to go forward. And they've got great ideas. I mean, maybe their organization in their country might not be as successful as SWE, but they've got good ideas. They've done things. They've had successful programs of outreach with college girls and so forth. And we can learn from them. So I think the big thing was listening and learning how to deal with the different cultures and make a win-win situation. Mm-hmm. So,
Have you drawn any conclusions, I guess, about the difference between the environment for women engineers in the U.S. versus other countries, or have you?
This is going to keep on ringing. You want me to just?
Oh, yeah, God. I'll pause it. Okay, we're back. Let's see, we were discussing differences between the environment for women engineers in the U.S. versus other countries.
No. I think it varies a lot. Some countries are one or two decades behind us. They're still stuck in their older cultures, their older perceptions and so forth. And so when you hear about their problems, it sounds like you're from a SWE meeting from 10, 20 years ago. You know, they're still in that time frame. So I think that's where we can share some of our successes and how we dealt with it as SWE over the last 10 or 20 years and give them ideas on how to deal with it. Others, the cultures are just very different. So they have problems, but they're different problems. And I don't think we have to deal with tribal issues. And the women in Africa have to deal with tribal issues on top of being women issues. And so that's been interesting learning about that. And so they have to deal with their challenges a little bit differently. The economy. I mean, here in the United States, we're blessed with a strong economy. We've got our problems now, but compared to other countries in the world, I mean, we are so wealthy. We have so much available to us in terms of education, resources they don't have in other countries. And so understanding they're coming from a whole different economic base. I think the thing in Africa right now, and some other the developing countries, they realize that if they want to grow, if they want to modernize, they have to use all their resources. And whether they like it or not, they have to educate their women and use their women. And I think they're learning that by educating the women, it's really helping advance their countries. Depending on their background, their colonial background and so forth, a lot of them, same thing, you know, they only thought they should have men in engineering. But I know, like in Kenya and some of the other countries in Africa, talking to the African women, it's really changed in the last 10 years. And they realize the success of educating women in technology areas, in like in engineering and computers, has really helped the countries move forward. And they realize it's not only helping with the country, but also with their families. That these women that are having jobs are also being able to support their families, and it's a stronger family structure because of it. So it's different. We don't think about that, you know, how's that helping our family structure? But for them, it's very, very important that you have a woman that's got a job that can bring an income in to pay the bills, basic survival for food and clothing and so forth. So it makes a big impact in the developing countries. So, but what was the original question? I can't remember.
I think that covered it. Okay. Just differences.
So. Yeah. And then in other countries, everyone's getting educated. And so they don't have the stereotypes of who should get this education or who should get that education. No one was educated, so now everybody's getting educated. So they don't have those stereotypes or they don't have those preconceived notions. You know, when no one went to college, now everyone has an opportunity to go to college. Whatever you want to study, study it, because we desperately need you to get a college education. So they don't really hit the stereotypes until maybe they get out in the working world or the global world economy, where they hit other companies or other cultures that still have that, you know, discrimination against women, that they have to deal with that, you know. So.
Okay. Is there anything else that you would like to add? Or
I don't think so. I think you've covered a lot more than I thought you were going to cover. So, I've enjoyed this very much. Very much.
I'm glad you have.
So, I appreciate you. Obviously, you've done your homework to come with all these questions.
Well, thank you very much for doing this interview.
Okay. Thanks.
Yep. Yeah.